This is Knowledge at Wharton, and you're listening to SiriusXM 111 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. We are with you each and every weekday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, 7 a.m. Pacific, and then our show replays in the evenings at 10 p.m. East, 7 p.m. out on the West Coast. And don't forget to visit the Knowledge at Wharton website, which has a variety of stories making news from around the globe. Go to knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu is the place to go. And when you get there, make sure that you sign up for the newsletters, which come at you every Wednesday and Friday. So the latest edition of the newsletter will be out tomorrow. Really a handy tool, brings all of those stories right to your inbox. And then also on the website, make sure that you scroll down the homepage and you will see a microphone icon, which will allow you to listen to our Knowledge in 5 podcast. Those are interviews from the show. We take them from the 20 to 25 minute length, pare down the best comments of our guests on that particular topic down to about 5 minutes, and let you listen to them at your leisure. All of that and much more at knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu. If you would like to also listen to the full interviews, you will find some on the website, and as well, you will find them on the Knowledge at Wharton page on iTunes, which is at Knowledge at Wharton on iTunes as well. If you go back 25 to 30 years, the idea of private prisons was one that seems to be the future of the sector, a way to cut costs while also introducing innovation and making the prison experience somewhat more palatable. Unfortunately, that necessarily hasn't been the case. Lauren Brooke Eisen takes an in-depth look at the problems of the private prison industry in her new book, Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. And it's great to have Lauren Brooke with us today. Lauren Brooke, thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be here.
Thank you. So looking now, what is the state of this industry right now? I guess I read that there are more than, 100,000 individuals that are in these types of facilities right now?
There are. At the state level, there are about 8% of incarcerated individuals are behind bars in private prisons. And at the federal level, it's a little bit more significant. About 18% of the incarcerated individuals in the Federal Bureau of Prisons are spending their time in these privately operated facilities. But something that a lot of people are not aware of is that we have privatized 65% of immigration detention beds in this country. So we've essentially privatized immigration detention, and this is certainly a growing industry for the corporations that run and operate these prisons and detention centers.
And seemingly it's even a bigger growing industry right now with some of the policy choices by the White House.
It certainly is, and in this most recent budget, the Trump administration has requested more than $1.2 billion in the 2018 federal budget to expand detention capacity. And specifically, they're hoping to expand detention to more than 48,000 beds a day. And to put this in perspective, the current daily capacity for immigration detention beds is closer to 28,000 to 38,000 beds. So what we're seeing right now is an indication that the Trump administration is hoping to put more people behind bars in these immigration detention facilities, and that will certainly be a big boon for the private industry.
Let's go back a little bit and have a little bit of a history lesson, if we can, on what was it that really drove the government to look to privatizing the prison system, or at least portions of it, to begin with.
What happened was that in the mid-1980s, about two-thirds of the states were under federal court order to improve conditions in their prisons because the conditions violated the U.S. Constitution. Prisons across the country had reached their breaking point. They were crowded, they were unhygienic, they were unsafe. There were stories of riots and escapes at state prisons all across the country. This wasn't isolated in one state. This was really a systematic problem. And policymakers were faced with really tough decisions. Many of them were facing court orders to release incarcerated individuals because the prisons were so unsafe. Yet at the same time, their constituents didn't want to fund this incarceration binge, right? Everyone wanted tough on crime and more prison and more incarceration, but taxpayers were really not willing to foot the bill. So what happened was the private industry came in and they said, look, we'll take care of building these prisons and you can pay us to operate them. And that's exactly what happened. And, you know, the story of private prisons really started in the halls of the Tennessee Capitol building during the fall of 1985 when a new company called Corrections Corporation of America, it's now rebranded itself and it's known as CoreCivic, made an unprecedented offer at the time. They offered to take over the state's entire prison system for $250 million and a 99-year lease. And Tennessee ultimately rejected the offer, but it made headlines. And, you know, if any story sort of has a moment, that's certainly an important moment because people started to pay attention to the private prison industry and the potential that they thought it brought with it to house so many incarcerated individuals in the country.
So how many companies are we looking at now that are in this industry, and how many prisons are they overseeing at this point?
There are the two biggest private prison corporations are actually real estate investment trusts. So they're REITs, and they're publicly traded on the stock market. Those corporations are CoreCivic and Geo Group. And what's happened is they have, the industry has consolidated over the years, and those are really the two most your largest corporations right now that run these prisons and immigration detention centers. There's also a third company, the third largest corporation that runs prisons and detention centers, and that's MTC Corporation. And then there are other smaller corporations. There's LaSalle Corporations, some family-owned corporations that are just much smaller that tend to have, you know, fewer facilities. So when we talk about the industry, most people think about these two corporations that are publicly traded on the stock market. And they're fairly profitable. The Geo Group and CoreCivic alone earned a combined $4.3 billion in 2016. And that's just two companies.
So, and these facilities, I mean, obviously when these companies started to be able to acquire some of these, they were pitching them as, hey, we can do this. It takes probably financial elements off the books for the state government or the federal government, whoever was actually running the facility. I guess the question is, how are they running them? Are they doing, it seems like not a great job in running these facilities in terms of the upkeep, the conditions, and a variety of elements.
And that's a very important and relevant question. And for research for the book, I looked at a lot of the research studies over the last 3.5 decades. And when these corporations, when they started to house so many incarcerated individuals in the mid-80s and early 90s, they marketed themselves as, you know, here's the private sector coming in to do a better job than what the government is doing. And at the time, a lot of policymakers, directors of corrections, they really thought that the private sector had great potential to possibly do a better job than the government was doing of running prisons and jails. And the government wasn't doing a very good job. The government was overwhelmed. And, you know, the heads of these corporations went on 60 Minutes, and they testified at, you know, their first congressional hearings in the 1980s. And they promised innovation, and they promised cost savings. And 3.5 decades later, you know, this book makes the point that we haven't seen that. And we have not asked these corporations to beat the government's rate of recidivism, for example. And the rate of recidivism in this country is pretty terrible. About 75% of those who are released from prison return to prison within 3 years. And the book argues that we should finally hold these corporations' feet to the fire and rewrite these contracts and ask them to beat the government's lousy recidivism rate. If they're going to make a profit off of incarceration, we haven't asked them to do very much other than just be a government partner.
But what about finding the information out about how they are running them and how they are profitable? I was reading that I guess there are a few states where it is required under the Freedom of Information Act that organizations can be able to find this information out, but it's not universal across all 50 states.
It's absolutely not universal, and that's something that's very problematic when we talk about the private prison industry. It is plagued with lack of transparency and lack of accountability. And you're absolutely right that at the federal level, these private prison corporations are not required to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. That's the FOIA requests. And at the state level, almost no state has specific legislation mandating that private prisons need to comply with these open records requests.
Mm-hmm.
Some states have statutes on the book indicating that private industry that is acting as a government partner or performing a government function needs to require with their open records requests. But those states are few and far between, and most states in this country do not require these corporations to comply with the same open records request that a government prison would have to comply with.
We are joined by Lauren Brooke Eisen, who is the author of the book Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. You're more than welcome to join in the conversation with your comments. 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. If you're not able to get to your phone, you're more than welcome to send us a comment on Twitter, and we'll bring it up on the show that way, at BizRadio111, B-I-Z-Radio111, or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. So what is the government doing, whether it be the federal government or the individual state governments? Are they recognizing some of the issues with these contracted prisons, and are they starting to try and, you know, work it through the system to address a lot of the issues here?
So at the federal level, we have seen policymakers introduce legislation session after session to try to curb the nation's reliance on private prisons. So Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee has introduced legislation, I believe, 6 times in Congress. It just hasn't really moved past committee. And her legislation would increase transparency and accountability in the private prisons in the country. We've also seen Bernie Sanders has introduced legislation session after session to try to eliminate the private prisons. And none of the legislation on the federal level has moved. At the state level, there have been some state legislators. California recently had some successful legislation to curb the continuing growth of immigration detention centers that are privatized. And we're starting to see a little bit of movement at the state level. But it's certainly something that constituents should be calling their policymakers at the state and federal level and asking them to focus on legislation that improves the accountability and transparency of these prisons. When we talk about prisons, we know so little about what happens behind closed doors anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And when we try to gather information about assaults, riots, incidents that happened at private prisons and private immigration detention centers, it's just much more difficult to gain access to that information. And so if we want to improve conditions of confinement, if we want to make sure that, these situations don't repeat themselves, we need to know what went wrong, why things went wrong. And that information is very difficult to come by when we're looking for information about what happened in these private facilities.
Well, I was reading that I guess there are some of these facilities that don't even prefer to have family members of incarcerated people visit the prisons. They would much rather them call those people on the phone, correct?
That's a growing trend in incarceration, and the book looks at the vast prison industrial complex. These are the corporations that profit off of incarceration that are, corporations outside just these private prison corporations that run brick-and-mortar facilities. So, for example, there's a corporation called JPay that many call the Apple of the U.S. prison system. And for a fee, and it's a pretty hefty fee, it can be, $7 to $10, an incarcerated individual can FaceTime or Skype or video conference with their family. And a lot of prisons, you're right, are moving towards asking their incarcerated individuals to only communicate with family members on the phone or through this video conferencing. And they're restricting the number of in-person visits at their facilities or eliminating them entirely. And we know so much about reducing recidivism and improving someone's prospects for reentry once they are released from prison, and ties to your community and you being able to physically touch and hug your family members is really important. And the book explores sort of the whole privatization of the justice system. And so these companies are important to study and understand when we talk about making money off of incarceration.
844-942-7866 is the number to give us a call. 844-942-7866. Lauren Brookeisen is the author of the book Inside Private Prisons. You can also send us a comment via Twitter, either at BizRadio111, B-I-Z Radio 111, or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. One of the interesting pieces to this is that some of these prisons are in, you know, are in cities or locations where the prison itself is a pretty big economic component. Now, some of these facilities were kind of on the way out through the dealings or the want of the Obama administration prior to the shift in office. You mentioned how the Trump administration is starting to rely on them a little bit more. From an economic perspective, some of these prisons are very important components to some of these locations.
They are, and the book looks at the lure of the prison industry and the private prison industry as well to small rural towns, because these prisons are a boon for jobs, infrastructure, economic viability. And, you know, the book specifically looks at the town of Appleton, Minnesota, and how the community members of that town try to lure, furniture manufacturing plant, a casino, all of this to improve the economic viability of the town that was devastated by the recession of the early 90s. And eventually they built a prison. And, you know, they looked at it. These are officials who had no corrections experience. But this was an economic infrastructure plan. And this happened all across the country in the mid-1980s and in the 1990s. People looked to prisons to improve their economy, and that's still happening today. Very recently, a private prison closed in Encinal, New Mexico, and members of that town were, you know, speaking at city council meetings, and it has been devastating to the economy. It closed a couple of weeks ago, and it's already been devastating. And this is one of the problems with relying on incarcerating individuals for economic viability. You know, it's very different from trying to lure a big box store or restaurants to your town. I mean, this is, you know, putting people behind bars so that the economy of your town is improved.
Well, I mean, are these facilities, the private facilities, are they being run, when you think about the rules that are being used in these facilities, are they being run fairly similar to the state or the federal prisons?
What happens is government signs, so the government delegates the responsibility to these corporations to operate them. There are corrections officers who are employees of these private prison corporations. And so instead of wearing, let's say, a New Mexico Department of Corrections badge on their uniform, they'll wear a, you know, Core Civic badge on their uniform or Geo Group badge on their uniform. And the rules are, they tend to be governed by the contract. But the reality is there may be one monitor from the Department of Correction who's there, you know, from 9 to 5. And in some states, actually a lot of states, there's no Department of Corrections monitor who's there every day. Huh. Someone may travel to different private prisons at different times of the year, but is not physically there permanently. And so these prisons are run by the private corporations. They are supposed to follow the rules of the state and the State Department of Corrections rules, but the people who are running these places are private employees of these private corporations. It's not, they're not run by Department of Corrections employees.
Right. Great having you on the show today, Lauren Brook. Thank you very much for your time. We wish you all the best with this project.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration is the book. Lauren Brook Eisen is the author of the book. Many thanks to her for joining us here on the show. We will take a break. Our next hour will include a conversation about what would be the impact of a tie-up between 21st Century Fox and Disney. And then also we will talk about the book, The Miseducation of the Student Athlete. It is a topic going around and around NCAA and college campuses right now, partly in wake of what happened at the University of North Carolina, or maybe what didn't happen at the University of North Carolina. We'll talk about that as well in hour number two of our show. More coming up in just a minute. You're listening to Sirius XM 111, Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.